The following is a recording of the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. We are also located on the web at www.tpuuf.org. Please come visit us.
Good morning and welcome to the online worship service of Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We're located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. This morning, however, we are as close to you as your own home. I'm the Reverend Larry Pierce. I'm the minister at Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, and I want to welcome you into this circle that's gathered this morning. We are welcoming you into this place wherever you are on your life journey, wherever you are on your spiritual journey, however tired you might be this morning, or how much rebounding energy you might have. Whomever you love, whatever your gender, identity, or expression, we welcome you into this ever-expanding circle of compassion and love. If you happen to be a visitor today for the first time, you'll notice in our chat box a link to our virtual visitor card. And there you can tell us a little bit about yourself so we have a chance to get to know you a little bit, share with you any information that you request, and you can fill out that form anytime during this service. So let me open this worship with these opening words written by Joan Javier Duval. Here is where you can lay it down. Lay down all that you have carried, the weight of the world that has rounded your back, leaving you aching and exhausted. Here is where healing begins, where burdens are set down and alongside one another's, their magnitude does not seem as great. Here is where the door is thrown open and the light can lift away the shadows and what was hidden can now be seen. Here is where you can rest, where nothing is expected, but that you bring all of who you are into the presence of the holy and of this loving community. Come, let us worship together. And now Manny will light our chalice and give us our chalice lighting words for this service. Manny.
As I prepare to light our chalice this morning, let's remind one another to enter this circle with our authentic whole selves, nothing less. As a reminder, I share these words by the Reverend Angela Herrera. Don't leave your broken heart at the door. Bring it to the altar of life. Don't leave your anger behind. It has high standards, and the world needs vision. Bring them with you, and your joy, and your passion. Bring your loving, and bring your courage, and your conviction. Bring your need for healing, and your powers to heal. There is work to do, and you have all that you need to do it right here in this room. Let it be so.
And now I will light the peace lamp. You will repeat after me and with all the people of the world. May peace be with us and with all the people of the world.
Our gathering song this morning will appear on your screen. The lyrics will be there so you can sing along. Our song leader is Christine Perry. And she's also going to accompany herself on guitar as she sings. This hymn is Soon the Day Will Arrive. So join in when you're ready. Let's begin our worship and our gathering together with this song, Soon the Day Will Arrive.
Soon the day will arrive when we will be together and no longer will we live in fear. and the children will smile without wondering whether on that day thunder clouds will appear. Wait and see what a world there can be if we share. Dreamed, some have died to make a bright tomorrow, and our vision remains in our hearts. And now the torch must be passed with new hope, not in sorrow, and a promise to make a new start. Wait and see.
So if you happen to have downloaded our order of service for this morning, you'll notice that we will engage now in what I've called a ritual of lamentation as improvised hope. Now, some of you might say, lamentations? What is that? Some of you may know that it is a collection, a book of lamentations that is in the Hebrew scriptures. Some of you may have read the book. Some of you may say, I haven't read the book, but I've seen the movie. Some of you may say, I haven't read the book, I haven't seen the movie, but I've been in that movie for so long. I know exactly what it means to hold lament for our world and for others that I care about. And so lamentation as improvised hope comes from an author who's a commentator on Lamentations. And she says, whenever we have a lamentation, it's because we are experiencing a gap between what is and what could be. And we hold alongside of our sorrow that hope as well. And so in a moment, I'm going to ask you to think about whatever lamentation you have been holding during this period of time that we have been going through as a country, that maybe you have gone through personally or your family, to think about what is that lamentation. And think about what is the hope that goes alongside of that lamentation that allows you to kind of experience the gap between what is and what you hope could be. And we're going to invite you in a moment to, if you happen to have seen the email, to light a candle or a chalice to represent that hope. And we're going to be in the gallery screen, a gallery view to see that while we play some music. But you might be thinking, my goodness, how can I begin to think about a hope that was somehow alongside of my own lamentation? And so I want to share this quick reading from Amy Lamont, in which she says, during a children's sermon, the pastor asked the kids to close their eyes for a moment, to give themselves a timeout. So I'm asking you to give yourself a timeout right now. And then he asked them, what is it that they heard during that timeout? So I'm asking you to think about, what is it that you're hearing alongside of whatever lament you have held in yourself in recent times? The children said they heard birds and radios and dogs and barking and cars, but there was one boy who said, I hear the water at the edge of things. And so I invite you to think about what is at the edge of your own lamentation. And when you're ready, I'd ask you to light your candle to represent that hope that is there in spite of, or maybe even because of, whatever lament you've had for our world. And light your candle and hold it up close to the screen. Now, if you didn't happen to bring a candle, just touch your heart like this. And then we'll hear some music as we look at the gallery and welcome each other's hopes and welcome each other. So if you don't have a candle, touch your heart. If you have a candle, you can light it to represent that hope. So great to see each of you this morning holding that candle and hopefully holding some hope for our world. It's so great to see each of your faces. It's so great to be in your presence, even in this way, because I know that there is a strength in our coming together. So thanks for bringing your candle. Thanks for adding your hopes alongside of each other so that together we may hold a space for a world that wants to emerge. So some of my clergy colleagues have been going through various mental contortions in preparing their sermons for this particular post-election Sunday with so much uncertainty that was in the atmosphere. Some wondered, what would they preach if their particular candidate lost? And one of my minister friends, who actually had viewed the video of my pre-election sermon a few weeks ago that maybe some of you heard, Make Them Hear You, she offered me this advice. She kind of relieved me by saying, Larry, you could preach that same sermon again no matter who wins, since the work before us remains the same. She was right. Not that I should preach the same sermon. That was a little tempting, but she was right that the work before us, as I laid it out in that sermon, remains the same. now this Sunday, after the election, we still have increasing cases of the pandemic. We still have those who are living at the edge or beyond the edge of their own means. Those who worry about what would happen if they get sick. Those who are grieving. Those who have felt left out and discarded by the so-called American dream. And of course, we still have our ailing Earth. So obviously, that work remains. But this morning, I want to focus on the inevitable interior work that goes alongside of these real conditions, and could, my hope is, allow us to approach those tasks forthrightly, faithfully, and deliberately. Perhaps you've already begun to feel some inner shift in yourself, some sense of settling down and settling in. I want to see your hands if you're feeling any of that kind of things as a result of this tense election period concluding. And so let's allow ourselves to cherish whatever shift we're feeling, even if we don't understand it or if we understand it so well. I want to start my conversation with you about that interior work that I think happens alongside of this clear task that we have before us. I want to start where I started and where my thinking has been in the last few weeks. And I'm going to begin with a story. Once upon a time and long ago, I was just a mere child in a Catholic school. But once a week in this Catholic grammar school, St. Thomas Aquinas, we were given a pass to the school library. If you knew anything about me then, if you know anything about me now, I love to read. And that was certainly true then. However, I went through a period, I think it was maybe around sixth grade or so, where I started to read, brace yourself, a series of books on Catholic saints. Now, you can imagine that these books were meant to tell fantastic stories about extraordinary people who often did tremendous things for other people, helping lepers, caring for the poor, starting hospitals for the sick, forming communities that would also serve others. And they also even did some occasional miracles, some miracles even after they died, according to these stories. Now, I'd be the first to admit this was a little atypical, an atypical path of study that I took on for a sixth grader. But while my peers were reading comic books about superheroes, I was reading about another kind of superhero of sorts, saints. Both categories, however, I might argue, included this underlying message that anything is possible, that good could eventually triumph over evil, and that there was a power that could extend from and through a person to do things of extraordinary love and care and compassion. Now, sure, it was atypical that I preferred reading the lives of saints and comic book heroes, but now you know just a secret behind my own saintliness. I was tutored in it at a very early age. So when I moved from reading about the saints, I gravitated toward reading biographies for some of the same reasons about people like Helen Keller and Gandhi, Albert Schweitzer and others. I devoured these books, and for some reason or another, I was interested in how real people live their lives, even as my own life was forming ideas of who I would become. I craved for this inspiration, and I longed for some morsels of hope and possibility. And I was especially drawn to stories about people who overcame obstacles and became one way or another, neither with a saintly priestly cassock or a magical cape, a moral force for good in the world. I have to tell you, however, this was not thoroughly a mere fantasy world for me. I actually had some real life examples of people in my home, in my school, in my church, who gave their life to something bigger than themselves, who seemed to channel a power of good for the common good, in spite of and often because of what had happened to them. Their resoluteness, their relentlessness is what captivated me, as well as the stories. As I look back on those years, I didn't know then, and I believe now, that I was building a kind of spiritual reservoir that has served me one way or another throughout my life. And I long for the same kind of experience for the children in our world today, an opportunity to hear the stories of people who demonstrate character, moral strength, and commitment to what is good, what is just, and what is true, to for these children to see living examples of such people in their own lives. Now, of course, I was reading from only a subsection of the library, one turn in another direction, and maybe I could have easily found stories of those who unleashed hate or division or evil or destruction and even death through how they lived their lives. That's true too, but I gravitated towards these superheroes for me. Call me naive, call me optimistic, call me a Pollyanna, call me a product of Catholic education, attribute to it whatever you would. But I still hold on to that conviction that it matters. It matters what we do. It matters where we aim our life. It matters what we dedicate ourselves to doing. It matters who we are. And our character matters. Maybe I'm not so odd. There's no need to answer that question now in the chat or any other time, but maybe because we are all gathered here this morning, you too have some inkling in the direction that it matters what we do. It matters what principles we use to guide our life by. It matters where we aim our life. It matters how we treat others. It matters who we are. This would all seem so matter of fact, so unnecessary to have to say out loud some years ago, but sadly this country has seemed to have drifted in some scary directions that has swept aside sometimes common decency, that has swept aside truth-telling and compassion for the least fortunate in some corners that we cannot see. But yesterday, something seemed to have shifted. Although I'm not a parent, I could not help but cry along Van Jones on CNN yesterday when explaining how he felt following the election results. Maybe you saw this too. He said, "It's easier to be a parent this morning. It's easier to be a dad. It's easier to tell your kids that character matters. It matters. Telling the truth matters." I think that's what my reminiscing on the earlier really reading period in my life was all about. It's about character and the power of character. I'm not a parent, but I too have been hurting inside. I've pondered, what is it that contemporary parents have to tell their children about the world, about what's right and what's good, when so many values that we do not want to impart on our children have been on display, on public display, these last few years? It seems so basic, doesn't it? So essential, but the dramas we've experienced in recent years and in recent days even require us to have to claim this again and again. This is not a political commentary. This is a commentary that comes from our own stance as Unitarian and Universalists. Our Unitarian forebears were aligned with this thinking. So in the 19th century, when the theological debates were trying to grapple with some new understanding of ancient dogmas through an Enlightenment lens, our forebears emphasized ethics rather than dogma. They were among those who would write, "A man is not a Christian in proportion to the amount of truth he puts into his creed, but in proportion to the amount of truth he puts into his life." It may seem quaint to us now, but our religious ancestors advocated for salvation by character, for the importance of the kinds of qualities we cultivate in ourselves and among ourselves, in our families, in our congregations, in our communities, qualities that once we've cultivated them could benefit not just us, but guide our specific actions in the world. Now, what we are experiencing in this country, some authors point out, is a global phenomenon, not just in this country or in one political party or one political figure. There are many examples of what these writers call post-truth politics, which is exhibited by spreading disinformation, doubt, and denial, of architectures of separation, which generate polarization, tribalism, and hate, of fueling of fear, amplifying anxiety or depression and fear. And have you noticed any of that over the last number of years? Have you noticed signs and symptoms of that? Let me see a hand, let me see something. If you've noticed it, okay. So once we name it and describe it, we can begin to say there's that and there can be this. So maybe something is beginning to shift in you today. These forces are so strong, however. These clouds won't automatically lift. The habits that some have developed won't easily be dispelled. But I want to say to you, to us, to anyone who comes into our sacred circle of worship with one another today, that the way forward means that all of us must orient ourselves towards truth and humble ourselves within actual reality. None of us is exempt from these behaviors. All of us must orient ourselves anew towards what I am proposing. When we gather in this sacred circle, we can relieve ourselves of any attempts to be our own spin doctor of the harsh realities that we're actually in. We can tell truth and be in truth with one another. We need spaces like this to be able to name reality. And when we do, we will necessarily bring our tears and our joys, our dismay, as well as our caring. Let's remind ourselves of some of the words that Manny read from Reverend Angela Herrera this morning. Don't leave your broken heart at the door. Bring it to the altar of life. Don't leave your anger behind. It has high standards, and the world needs vision. Bring your need for healing and your powers to heal. There is work to do. Yes, there is work to do. I would continue. It's because I believe that this work, this real work, needs to be oriented towards the sick, the dying, the grieving, the struggling, the hungry, the left out and the left behind, towards ourselves and towards another. And I also believe in the work that we need to do. We need to do it with truth-telling, not delusional thinking. We need to focus, not with unnecessary distraction or disinformation and denial. In order to do this interior work following this election, we need to heal and we need to ground ourselves again in what truly matters. Yes, we have to heal from the chronic reactivity that we've been in, the collective trauma and the fueling of fear that activates our amygdala towards fight, flight, premature appeasement. We do not need to appease those who would spread disinformation or doubt, those who would distract us from the real world work that we need to do around us and within ourselves. Our country's own moral and social compass seems to have been going a little haywire. And yet, I also believe there have been some grounding forces that have resisted and have risen up from all of this and that have spoken. May we hear them. Let's reground ourselves deliberately, recenter ourselves. Let's realign ourselves to broader principles that can be compass points, guiding stars, and orienting points for a life that has purpose, for an earth that can be transformed by our care, for a care of self that can also become a care for the common good. I have to admit, I've been seeking that regrounding. And in recent weeks, I found myself reverting back to reading biographies, biographies of people who did extraordinary things, who had some kind of moral compass, who gave their lives towards what matters, not just to themselves, but to others as well. Now, these are not people, again, with priestly cassocks, not people with magic capes that have somehow allowed them to fly above the harsh realities of life. These are people who know all too clearly life's harshness, and yet they have persisted. These can be our teachers now as we move into a necessary recovery process moving forward. Let me introduce you to some of them and to their lessons. One of those is Viktor Frankl, who some of you may remember as the author years ago of Man's Search for Meaning. When Viktor Frankl was arrested in 1941 and sent to labor camps, he'd already been lecturing for some years and counseling young people and others who struggled with what they wanted to do with their lives and whether their lives even mattered. In fact, he had written an unpublished manuscript on this topic, and he had to sew it into the lining of his overcoat, which he wore when he was arrested on that day. Although he had to relinquish this overcoat in which his life work up to that moment was hidden, he did not abandon this commitment to this purposeful work. He held on to the aspirations to once again someday speak on this and help others, even while he endured the horrors of his imprisonment. Even in the limited confines of his labor camp, he observed and assisted his fellow prisoners to see what kind of choices they still had that they could make, even in limited circumstances. And as he helped to remind them of an inner freedom of choice that could not be extinguished by circumstances alone, he helped bring healing and perspective to them. So I just knew that I had to read Frankl's recently published book of his lectures that were given 11 months after he was liberated from the unspeakable horrors of that labor camp. What could a man who had seen and endured such horrors have to say that would be helpful? What could he say just 11 months after being released from that labor camp? Would he have to say? Well, the title of the book, which was published for the first time in English this year, probably captures the gist of his message. The title is Yes to Life in Spite of Everything. Yes to Life in Spite of Everything. I don't always feel that way, but I could certainly appreciate that message coming from a man like Viktor Frankl. I imagine some of the audiences who heard him speak following the horrors of the Nazi terror and regime that had overtaken his country, they too wondered. After all the horrors that they had seen, the human evil that had seen towards other humans, they also were recovering from the false narratives and the propaganda. They were recovering from their own indifference and silence and their own overwhelm. They probably wondered, does it really matter? Does life really have meaning in the face of all these horrors? And Frankl replied from his own experience. The question, he said, is no longer, does life have meaning? But he said, the question is, what does life expect of me? What task in life is waiting for me? He went on, it is this life that asks the questions of us. We are the ones who are being questioned. We are the ones who must answer, who must give answers to the constant hourly question of life, to the essential life questions. Living itself means nothing other than being questioned, he writes. And our whole act of being is nothing more than responding to, of being responsible towards life. So as we move forward from this moment, we need to resist the temptation to think we can just let down our guard, feel complacent that it's all been accomplished. We need to keep asking, What is life asking of us now? What questions is life asking of us now? You might pause and ask that self, yourself that same question, either now or sometime this week. What questions is life asking of us now? How might we respond in meaningful ways? So another volume I pulled off the shelf is the story of Valerie Carr. She provides another grounding story for me, and perhaps for you. She's an author and a Sikh activist who had more reasons than I suspect most of us have to just give up, to lay low, to relinquish hope, even from an early age. She recalls that she experienced early on in the schoolyard as a little girl growing up in California, where her family had lived for a long time. And she was told in the schoolyard that she would go to hell because she was not Christian. She was called a black dog because she was not white. She ran home into her grandfather's arms crying. And Papa G, she says, dried my tears. He gave me the words of Guru Nanak, the founder of the Sikh faith. These words, "I see no stranger," said Nanak. "I see no enemy." My grandfather taught me that I could choose to see all the faces I meet and wonder about them. And if I wonder about them, she says, I will listen to their stories, even when it's hard. I will refuse to hate them even when they hate me. I will even vow to protect them when they are in harm's way. That's what it means to be a Sikh, to walk the path of a warrior saint. And then her grandfather told her the story of the first Sikh woman warrior, Mai Bago. The story goes, there were 40 soldiers who abandoned their post during a great battle against an empire. And they returned to a village, and this village woman turned to them and said, "You will not abandon the fight. You will return to the fire, and I will lead you." And so this woman, this Sikh woman, mounted a horse. She donned a turban, and with a sword in her hand and fire in her eyes, she led them where no one else would. She became the one she was waiting for. "Don't abandon your posts, my dear," my grandfather said to her, her grandfather said to her. And he saw me as a warrior. I was just a little girl in two long braids, but I promised I wouldn't. So my friends, think of that grandfatherly advice that she received. Don't abandon your post, my dear. It served her then, and through all of the polarization and hate that emerged following 9/11 and the violence towards those who had darker skin, who wore turbans, who looked like Muslims to some, including a family friend who she called uncle, who was murdered soon after 9/11 as he stood outside of his grandfather. She didn't give up. She did not abandon her post. She stood up against that kind of hatred, that kind of polarization. So what kind of grandfatherly, grandmotherly advice do you have to offer the next generation? And I'm looking in the eyes of all of you who are either grandmothers or grandfathers, or grandmotherly or grandfatherly, and I'm asking you, what's the wisdom that you would want to offer the next generation at this moment, at this juncture, at this open moment in our own life and our own history? Maybe I'll begin to hear some of those pieces of advice during our Matters of the Heart. Maybe you can share a story that grounds you. I'm interested in knowing. We need to gather that wisdom together. So I got a chance to meet Viktor Frankl before when he lectured in Boston before he died in 1997. I've only met Valerie Carr from her book and her videos, but but this next person I will hold up as a grounding influence is Parker Palmer, who I do know and have known since my early 20s as a mentor. And I've spoken about him before. I got to know him during a time when I sought some new grounding for my life, some new ways to orient myself at that particular juncture in my life. Little did I know at the time that I met him, but Parker was experiencing some of his own struggles with depression and uncertainty, which he writes in his books, which often read like memoirs because he includes so many rich stories about how he comes to know what it is that he knows. There's one particular book, Let Your Life Speak. It draws upon a Quaker adage, let your life speak means to, in quotes, let the highest truth and values guide everything you do. Of course, that's the ideal. We'll always fall short of our ideals. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't uphold some ideals in any case, but we know that if we orient ourselves and aim ourselves towards what we want our lives to say, that that's much better than a haphazard, random, uncentered, ungrounded, aimless kind of life, in my opinion. So Palmer offers this reinterpretation of this Quaker adage that's been honed through his own struggles and his own fulfillments in life. He writes, before you tell your life what you intend to do with it, listen for what it intends to do with you. Before you tell your life what truths and values you've decided to live up to, let your life tell you what truths you embody, what values you currently represent. That's a good thing to reflect on this week. I think this week, as we move from all the hype and hecticness of the election time, hopefully, what is it that our life currently says to us about what we value? So we now face an opportunity to let our country speak in ways that are responsive to the true divisions that we are actually experiencing. And Parker has turned his attention to what he calls the healing of democracy. Beyond just being incidental citizens where we exercise our vote and campaign for our candidates periodically when called to do so, he says we need to enter into what it really means to be protectors of democracy, to harbor and hone democratic values and processes in our everyday life, in our conversations, in our groups, in all the places where our life intersects with the broad arena of the communities that we're part of. He says the healing of democracy requires everyday practices of deep listening and making sure our voices are heard and stories are told, and connections are made with one another when connections can be made. He offers a challenge to us against the real and prevailing global forces that I mentioned earlier of post-truth politics, of architectures of separation, and the fueling of fear. So it may seem quaint, but he says the work begins in the heart. What I have called the interior work this morning, Parker calls the work of the heart. So this, my friends, is not a hearts and flowers approach to understanding the heart. Instead, he draws upon the root meaning of heart as represented in that French word for heart, cœur, and denotes that it has within it that same root of the word courage. So the work of the heart requires courage, the courage of our convictions, the courage of taking a stand, the courage to be able to say it matters, the courage to be what it is that we're waiting for in the world. Parker's wisdom has recently been summarized in this way. For those of us who want to see democracy survive and thrive, and we are legion, The heart is where everything begins, that grounded place in each of us where we can overcome fear, rediscover that we are members of one another, and embrace the conflicts that threaten democracy as openings to new life for us and for our nation. We're going to be going through tensions, personal and political, perhaps the most fundamental and most challenging ones, I think, as we move through these next weeks and these next years, is standing and acting with hope in the tragic gap that we're living in, the gap between what is and what we want to see, the gap between being able to actually see the hard realities of the world, realities that can crush our spirits and defeat our hopes on the one hand, and on the other hand, on the other side of that gap, we can see real world possibilities, life as we know it could be, because we have seen it that way. We're going to be in that tragic gap between actuality and possibility, but it's how we navigate and manage that gap. Do we give in to the tremendous overwhelmness of the actual reality, or do we orient ourselves towards possibility and hope? That's our work. That's our interior work. So my friends, can we stand together in that all too real tragic gap between the hard realities of our time and the real world possibilities? Please hear me. I'm not proposing appeasing the powers of denial, disinformation, and doubt. I am not proposing giving in to the forces that through denial or disinformation cause us to doubt our own truth, to doubt human decency, and to relinquish the importance of character. No, I'm not saying that. We need to be grounded. We need to not abandon our posts. We need to be able to say yes to life no matter what is happening. And finally, another grounding influence for me is the wisdom of the scriptures that have come to us through the ages. Here's a modern interpretation of the verses from Jeremiah 17, 8 through 9, that Pete Seeger's hymn that we'll close with today captures. The verses are, but blessed is the man, and this is a modern version, but blessed is the man who trusts me, God, or some of us might prefer to say the good, or the woman who sticks with God, or some of us might want to say with the good. They're like trees replanted in Eden, putting down roots near the rivers, never a worry through the hottest of summers, never dropping a leaf, serene and calm through the droughts, bearing fresh fruit every season. Yes, like trees planted by the waters, we shall not be moved. But I'll give you my own modern interpretation of these ancient verses, informed by the lives of those who stood up when it would have been easier to lie down, emboldened by the lives of those who pushed forward when it would have been much easier to say, what's the use? Strengthened by the courage of hope, of God, or of love, we will not wither, but bring forth the fruits of justice and mercy. Even as we struggle against the cray-cray around us, may we stay. May we not abandon our post. So those are the words I wanted to share with you today. And now we take a moment where we share matters of the heart. This is the time when we reflect on what it is that we've heard in the sermon or in the service, and we linger just a little longer there to share what it is we want to hold on to or hold up to one another. It's also the place where we can share briefly a joy that we're holding in our heart or a concern that we're holding. Let's take time during this musical interlude to pay attention to what gleanings we have from the sermon, what joys we're holding that we want to celebrate, and what sorrows we might have. We'll get instructions on that following the musical interlude, and then we will share. Thank you.
I extinguish this chalice flame. Yet may whatever light has accompanied us through this service carry us through the days ahead. Our closing words are from the late, great Maya Angelou. Just like moons and like suns, with the certainty of tides, just like hope springing high, still I rise.
Thank you, Manny. Our closing hymn is a familiar one to you, and it's the version of Pete Seeger's We Shall Not Be Moved. The words will appear on the screen. And think about the courage of your convictions, the courage of what it will take for us to be a real healing presence in the time that we're in. And think about all the people who are being named in this song as having a voice that's worth hearing as well. So let's sing together, We Shall Not Be Moved.
Let's stand by. Country together.
We shall not be
moved. Yeah.
City and country
together.
We shall not be
moved.
Just like a tree that's standing by the water. We shall not be moved.
We shall not.
We shall not. We shall not be
moved.
We shall not. We shall not be moved. Just like a tree that's standing by.
Yes.